Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 33, Revela Draconum, Draco Malfoy Revealed, where we will be talking with Louise Freeman and Beatrice Groves about Harry Potter's nemesis and bad boy fan favorite, Draco Malfoy. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. How are you doing today, John?
You know, I'm loving life here in Oklahoma. How are you, Katie?
I'm doing pretty well. This is the time of year when Oklahoma might have better weather than Ohio, so...
74 degrees today. Just saying.
I'm very jealous. Our special guests today are Dr. Louise Freeman, Professor of Psychology at Mary Baldwin University, licensed behavior analyst and service provider for special needs children, and the author of many articles about psychology in Harry Potter and other young adult literature. We're also joined by Dr. Beatrice Groves, Oxford Fellow and tutor in Renaissance English, author of Literary Illusion in Harry Potter, really wonderful book, and a blogger at MuggleNet's Batilda's Notebook. Y'all will all want to check that out, I know. All kinds of really good stuff in there, Bea. Both of you all are longtime friends of Reading, Writing, Rolling, and John and I are delighted to have you back to analyze the many facets of Draco Malfoy. Welcome back.
Thank you for having us, Katie.
Now, this episode comes from a fan request. The fan just said, I would really love a Draco show. Let's get into Draco's head. And I have to say that my experiences as a variety of conferences also suggest that there is a lot to unpack in Draco and that Draco is fascinating to readers and fans. It never fails that like a debate erupts about somebody talking about Draco. People have strong feelings. And so today we're gonna tickle the sleeping dragon, right? Draco dormiens titillator. Lori Beckhoff gave me some Latin phrases to throw around.
Thank you, Cormorant Strike.
That's right.
That's right. I know. Rowling likes to bring out her Latin. Let's talk a little bit about Draco, like the stereotype, you know, he's playing a certain role in the cast of characters. You know, you've got this aristocratic foil to the middle class hero, Harry. How well does Draco play this part? And is he able to transcend that kind of two-dimensional quality of that type of character, or is he really just in that kind of static mode? What do you all think? Cardboard character, or does he get fleshed out?
Well, let me ask a question. Speaking of flesh to flesh, I'm about the only true schoolboy fiction I've read in the traditional sense, beyond, of course, Harry Potter, which is a parody of that genre, is I did read Tom Brown's School Days at once, so I know a little bit about what Flashman, kind of the bully in that series. How common in the schoolboy fiction genre is it for the bully to have a redemptive moment at the end and sort of see the error of his ways and, if not fully become an ally of our hero, at least become less of an enemy? Is that a common thing? I seem to remember Flashman just sort of getting caned and getting shipped off and not really doing much, but it's been a long time since I've read that book, and I've never really read any others in that genre. So could someone more familiar with the basic British schoolboy fiction fill us in on that?
My memories of Enid Blyton and that type of fiction, which she's parodying, you know, this is mostly a rewrite of the Flashman, as you say, Louise, is punished and departs from the scene. And he's also he's significantly older than Tom Brown is. Mm-hmm. And so the bully, you know, has to be larger and stronger as well as wealthier to have this role. And he's punished and is exiled. I think in schoolboy fiction that Rowling is used to, which is serial fiction rather than just a one-off like Tom Brown is for the most part, you'll see a moment where they're crushed and they can be more sympathetic, like, oh, what a bad person I've been, especially in the school girl fiction.
Okay. But, that's interesting.
But not so much in things like Molesworth, where the bad guy is just the bad guy. And in fact, in Molesworth, I think the good guy is something of a bad guy. You know, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, but I was thinking of Stalky and Co. as well, which is similarly the good guys are more bad guys than they are in Harry Potter. And I don't remember a particular bully in that. You know, they bully people. There is a bully of a sort of a more of a Neville, weaker character who they to basically physically abuse and stop him bullying, but I don't think he has any redemptive moment.
No, and Beatrice, most people have not read Kipling, so you're going to have to introduce Stalky a little bit there.
So Stalky is this schoolboy novel by Rudyard Kipling, which is the sort of, I would say it was the most highly regarded literally, you know, as in a literary text of schoolboy fiction. It's quite difficult to read, and it has quite a lot of views about the way the world is, which don't sit very well with modernity, I'd say. But it is, it does have three, you know, the hero is a part of a threesome, and a lot of their hijinks they get up to do suggest that they are influential on Rowling, I think.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a Snape model, and there's... Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I'm interested that we right away did go to the bully idea. You know, that it's not, he's not just representing class, he's not just representing a kind of spoiled character, but what we're really associating with this role that he's been given in the series is bully, and that's his primary function. Do you think that's right?
Well, I mean, he's certainly Neville's bully. I mean, he torments Neville quite a bit. You know, of course, the bully is also typically big and strong. He is, of course, not big and strong, but he's got Crabbe and Goyle as his henchmen, who, you know, are the ones who are the physical threats and are his physical protectors. And they are, of course, I would say they are, of course, very one-dimensional in terms of, you know, they're just basically this big dumb thugs that are interchangeable. I mean, literally interchangeable. The when the actor who played what I think Crabbe got in trouble with the law, the movie just substitutes Goyle in for his role. And no sweat.
And I don't think there's any Crabbe and Goyle fan fiction, is there? It's not. They don't have the same appeal.
There's
not everything, but they don't have the Draco appeal.
No, that's true.
You don't have anyone really mourning their death or. Yes, Mary suing themselves into a relationship between Crabbe and Goyle. anyway, so he doesn't have that physically imposing threat of a physical bully. But, of course, in the wizarding world, you don't need to. If you've got a wand, you can do a lot of damage to a person that's much, much bigger than you, as Harry and Hermione and Ron proved with the troll. So up until about... book six, I would say he's pretty much a typical bad guy, bully, tormentor, snob character. You know, it's book six where he really gets broken by what he has now moved beyond the war was won on the playing fields of Eton. You know,
he's not at Eton anymore.
He's
in the war.
Hogwarts, but he has now joined the war and brought her literally into the school. And that just, when he's faced with that horror of it up close and personal, he just crumbles. When you have Moaning Myrtle feeling sorry for you,
it's a low.
Get bottom in terms of absolute misery.
Louise puts her finger on the turn in Draco, which is, of course, when his father is captured in the Ministry of Magic at the end of Order of the Phoenix.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that points out that Draco is largely a hand puppet to his father inside of Hogwarts. And when the hand is removed, Draco is left with who? The Dark Lord as his authority outside the school. This to me is the problem with Draco, is that people seem to like him or sympathize with him. Rowling has warned people away from this. Do not fall in love with Draco Malfoy, she says to young women. You know, this is not a man you want to bring home. You know, this is, and I think he is written as really the anti character to Harry Potter. He's not a reader. He's entirely about the narrative he's been given. He's going to ride it out, while Harry's narrative is entirely wide open, and he has to interpret all the texts around him to come to some grips with what's real. And we're on that adventure with him. And so this character that just gets to accept the text of his life, he was born to privilege. He's a leader inside Slytherin. He buys a spot on the Quidditch team. I mean, everything is given to him, and there's no chance for him to interpret or come to a new understanding. That's exactly the dead end that Rowling wants her readers to avoid and not to sympathize with.
I was thinking, I always think of Draco as like a combination of Little Lord Fauntleroy and Snidely Whiplash. It's kind of that combo. And yet I think he
should write fan fiction. You're great.
I think he should have been cooler at Hogwarts than he is. You know, he should be like popular. He should be like the man about campus. And he's really not. But I wonder if maybe he thinks he should be more popular than he is too. Harry maybe takes that from him. I'm not sure.
He's one of the few who we see with a girlfriend. I mean, Pansy Parkinson is clearly besotten with him. He's the prefect of his year in Slytherin.
Okay,
so
true.
He must have impressed someone. I mean, obviously you're not going to make Crabbe or Goyle prefect, but there were other choices. There are people like Blaise, Theodore Knott. There were, I think, more Slytherins who had been in trouble less than Draco, who, as far as we know, probably would have made better prefects. So it's always what I've always wondered, kind of, why did Dumbledore make Draco the prefect, especially when he did not make Harry one, and set that up. So, I mean, in some ways, he was kind of the ringleader in his Slytherin class. And, of course, I think the reason we don't see him as more popular in the school as a whole is because the Gryffindors hate the Slytherins, and most of the characters that we are empathizing with are the Gryffindors. So he's never going to be popular among that crowd.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'm influenced by like a whole genre of 80s teen movies that had James Spader in them. And I always thought, you know, Draco could have been like a James Spader. Now, that would have made him even more appealing to, you know, young women as the bad boy type. But because James Spader's just, you know, he's bad, but he's so charming at it. And Draco never really, he's not that appealing. But as you say, maybe that's because like we're definitely supposed to not find him appealing. Rowling is trying to hit that point over and over with us.
So he's the Slytherin. I mean, I think they, in the sorting ceremony, they say that, you know, the hat barely touches his hair before it says Slytherin. I mean, there's just absolutely no question.
Jim Kay brings that really nice with it in his first portrait of Draco, where it's when Harry first sees him having his clothes measured in Madame Malkin's, and he makes the measuring tape into a snake sort of over him. So it's sort of like ultimate Slytherin nature is very clear there. I just wanted to follow up on Katie's film connections, because I think there's another film that I'm sure is influencing Draco, which is the Young Sherlock Holmes from 1985. I don't know if any of you have seen that film. It's great. It's great fun, and it's got a character who is a blonde, sneering, upper class bully who looks down. He wants to make friends with Sherlock Holmes because he recognizes Sherlock Holmes is a bit special, just like Draco initially wants to make friends with Harry. And he sneers at his lower class friend Watson and says, "You know, why are you hanging around with this nobody? You know, come and join me." And his name is Dudley. Isn't that great? Bullies in Harry's life. Oh, he's a perfect sort of link character. That he also the film is definitely linked with Harry Potter in that it's written by Chris Columbus.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It was used as a trial. So when they were trying to find actors for Harry Potter, they used scenes from the young Sherlock Holmes to trial them because they saw it as quite similar. It's three school kids, examining a mystery. So it has, a specific link, and Chris Columbus went back, I think, to Oxford as a place to shoot quite a lot of Hogwarts, because Oxford is the main setting for that film, and he obviously saw various parts of Oxford and in his mind's eye and thought those will be great for Hogwarts, just like they were in the young Sherlock Holmes. But a Dudley connection, well, a Dudley Draco connection, is that Dudley in that film challenges Sherlock Holmes, as it were, to a duel of wits, not a literal duel, and he does that by hiding the fencing trophy, which then Sherlock Holmes has to try and find. And I thought, isn't that great that his first, the duel which challenges is in the trophy room. I'd say I think that was quite clever of Draco not to turn up for that. I thought that was you know, he's not, as you say, the most intelligent, but that was quite clever to sort of let Harry fall for that trick. That was quite effective one.
Let's talk a little bit about the Draco-Dudley connection, because you've got these two blondes who are, you know, definitely bullying Harry, and we're definitely not supposed to sympathize with them. They both have a kind of arc over the series that we might say they, you know, they do become more like people than like stereotypes. I know, John, you have some thoughts about this, the Dudley and Draco like combo, when we look at them together and what they're doing in the story. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I want to first comment that many of our listeners are probably saying, wait a minute, Dudley's a blonde? Because in the movie, he's not a blonde. But in the books, he is. And I think quite clearly you're meant to take Dudley, who bullies Harry quite, you know, vehemently and on a daily basis, as the Muggle equivalent of Draco. That he basically moves from one world in which he's bullied by a blonde, privileged young man to the next world where he's bullied by a blonde, privileged young man. And again, back to that point about narratives, Dudley watches television. He's either exactly what his parents, you know, he gets away with anything he can that his parents allow him to, which is everything. And then he goes to school and he becomes just the, you know, the cipher for the school's values and imperialist craziness. You know, he becomes the, what's it called? The Hastings stick or whatever. That persona is mirrored inside Hogwarts with Draco Malfoy and his being his parents' extension inside the school. And then he takes on Slytherin's qualities, the absolute worst qualities of that. That they both, in the end, have horrific experiences and are changed by them, I think Rowling is saying is that's almost what she wants for the reader. You know, the reader sitting at home is probably more like Dudley and Draco than he is like Harry Potter, not orphans and such, you know. And we all have our schools and we all have our families and all those influences, and we're trying to somehow get at what's real from behind the narratives we learn from them. Dudley is stunned, quite literally, by the Dementors, and his life changes at that point. He is horrifically challenged in that moment. And when we see him at the end of Deathly Hallows, it reflects somewhat. I mean, he's dull still. You know, he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he's at least reaching out to Harry saying, I don't think you're a worthless piece of space, you know, or a waste of space. And And Draco the same way. Draco is when his father is imprisoned and he makes the mistake of choosing then to ally himself with the Dark Lord. You know, the agony of Half-Blood Prince is largely the awakening of Draco to the prison in which he lives. What do you all think about the Draco-Dudley connection?
Well, I'm going to very shamelessly rip off Emily Strand's essay that she is working on for the Ivory Tower and Harry Potter Volume 2, which will be out hopefully in about a year, assuming the rest of us can get our essays done. But I was privileged to get a sneak preview of that. And she writes quite extensively about the parenting of both Dudley and Draco and how indulged they both are. I mean, you see, of course, that's how we first meet Dudley. Of course, he's counting his 43 birthday presents and is upset because he doesn't have 45. And
even before that, do you remember when he's a toddler and he just kicks his mum the whole way down the street because she's not giving him enough sweets?
Yes. when we first meet Draco, he's talking about, it's unfair, I can't have a broom. I think I'll bully father into getting me one. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, he knows exactly what he's doing in a way maybe that Dudley doesn't, that, hey, yeah, these are my parents. They're going to give me anything I want. Of course, then his father buys him a spot on the Quidditch team by buying everybody brooms. And so they both have this very, very indulgent parenting, which, of course, Dumbledore calls out at the beginning of book 6, not coincidentally, about the same time both Dudley and Draco are undergoing their transformation, as more damaging than the neglect and the abuse Harry got. He said, you know, you have damaged this unfortunate boy sitting between you. You know, I'm only grateful that you didn't damage Harry the way you damaged him. And so I think there's a very strong statement against that indulgent parenting in both those characters. And yes, that's absolutely shamelessly ripped off from Emily.
The way that that's translated into the way Dudley and Draco are operating in their worlds is that they are really both operating as part of their family. So they identify so strongly with their parents that they are going out and they're representing, right? This is the Dursley way. This is the Dursley way of viewing the world. And of course, Draco is all about the Malfoys and that sense of, you know, this is what it means to be a Malfoy. And they don't have like an independent agency beyond that family identification. And John and I were talking earlier, and John, you were pointing out that, of course, Harry as an orphan does not really have that same kind of influence. And although it is tragic that he's an orphan, that gives him a stronger ability to be an agent and to act independently.
Right. Mm-hmm. Harry, as a stranger to everything magical, comes into the world with, you know, a beginner's mind. He's constantly in wonder. He can't be estranged from the magical world. He's never experienced it. So he experiences everything anew and afresh, and he doesn't have family prejudices because he can't even remember his family. All he has is a natural resistance to authority because of the Dursleys. And Rowling, as I think Harry's definitely Rowling's, inserted character, you know, that he's between the eyes and the birthday and all these things, that this is the way you're meant to see the world. And Draco is the antithesis of that with Dudley. He's a spoiled person who's a prisoner of his family narratives and his identity within the school.
We can see that with Neville as well, can't we? If someone who's grown up without his parents and with a difficult home life, someone who's not accepting him, and that he too has found a completely sort of moral way of responding on his own. So I wonder if there's a sort of a faith in children that Rowling is trying to express and saying if they're, you know, they're either... If they're allowed to find their own way, they do okay. But if they are repressed by abusively spoiling parents, then they are ruined.
It's interesting. I've been doing, at the risk of turning this into the Dudley show rather than the Draco show, I've been doing a lot of close reading of the Dursley scenes for my own Ivory Tower essay. And what struck me is I hadn't fully grasped before on how much worse Vernon is than Petunia in terms of just his bullying. Petunia at least has a couple of redeeming moments. Dudley, of course, has some redemption at the end. Vernon never has any. And very similar, I think, to Lucius Malfoy in the same way that, you know, Narcissa had her moment when she protected Harry and lied to the Dark Lord for Harry and, you know, saved the day at that point. That was one of those crucial moments, small but crucial, that had she acted differently, the whole story could have gone a very different way. You know, Lucius just, he's been completely emasculated by the end of book seven, but he just doesn't seem to have any empathy, any real redeeming moment. He is just.
I think he has a slight one. So I think he does better than Vernon. So I think Vernon Petunia. I completely agree. There's an echo, but I think that the Malfoys, when they finally, and it says he like Narcissa runs through Hogwarts, not taking any part in the battle, just desperate to find his son. That is a redeeming moment for him.
That's why he's allowed
to join in, you know, at the end when everyone is sitting on their non-joined up tables. I think that is a moment for him. So I think the wizarding people get slightly better. I always felt that Petunia gets a raw deal in the sense that she's someone who's desperate to become a witch, and she's not allowed to because, you know, basically they didn't choose her, and that makes her deeply resentful. But it's a harsh backstory for Petunia that then never has any redeeming moment. And I think Rowling has said in an interview that she was intending to give her something, you know, like Dudley at the end, and then just didn't, perhaps because she wanted to stress Dudley's change more.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there was that very, it really ends quite ambiguously with Petunia, yet, you know, not so much with Narcissa. Yeah, it's funny that scene at the end of the Great Hall, that was the one thing that kind of, you know, in general, I despise the way the movies ended the whole Battle of Hogwarts, and I love the way the book did. But that having the Malfoys run away rather than having them just sort of hang around, I can't imagine that, you know, someone wasn't going to start beating on Lucius after they realized sitting there. I mean, Dean Thomas was imprisoned in his basement for however many months, and you've got all these people who knew exactly what he was. It's funny, I've never written any fan fiction, but I've always had this little bit of a scene in my head of Kingsley Shacklebolt showing up in the aftermath of the battle and trying to arrest them, and Harry saying, you know, telling him what Narcissa did for him and telling him what Draco did for him, and then looking at Lucius and saying, well, got nothing for you here, you know, take him away.
It's like the the Saturday Night Live thing where they redo the ending of It's a Wonderful Life. And they all go and beat up Mr. Potter. That just reminds me of, I guess.
Big old Death Eater. Take him away. Yeah.
So, yeah, some sort of fantasy where Lucius actually gets some comeuppance. Well, he has spent some time in Azkaban prison. So we are talking about the parents. We are, I think, starting to put Draco on the therapist's couch. And a little bit, you know, why he is the way he is. And Louise, I'm not sure if you were at this session at a Chestnut Hill Harry Potter academic conference meeting, but there was a person who was talking about bibliotherapy and using the Harry Potter books as bibliotherapy. And she actually used Draco as an example of somebody who was depressed. And in the question answer period, a huge debate broke out about whether he's depressed, whether he's abused, maybe he's just a spoiled jerk, you know, and there was they had to sort of corral the conversation because it went, it was intense.
This was 2 years ago, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I think I was moderating that session.
Oh, you have vivid memory.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. That was a really interesting talk. And I had written a whole paper about dementors and depression and various treatments of depression in Harry Potter, which I think is very interesting because, of course, we know that J.K. Rowling herself suffered a very severe form of clinical depression and has spoken openly about that. I had not considered Draco a depressed character before that. I think he certainly could be interpreted that way. I mean, there's certainly this, you know, one of the hallmarks of depression is this utter feeling of hopelessness. And you can certainly see that in Half-Blood Prince when he just knows there is no way he is going to come out of that. He's either going to have to kill Dumbledore or he's going to be killed himself. And he just doesn't see any way out of that and can't bring himself to offer the help that Dumbledore offers him. You know, he says, you know, I can protect you. We can fake your death basically and hide your mother, hide you. Your father's in Azkaban. He's safe. You know, there's another way out of here. And he, like a lot of depressed patients, he simply can't see that and can't and really resists the help at that point. In terms of that despair, that hopelessness, that anxiety, like I said, he's got Moaning Myrtle feeling sorry for him. This is about as low as you can go. I think there's also, of course, just a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety. I mean, he's got the Dark Lord in his home. We know at the beginning of Deathly Hallows, he sees Voldemort feed his teacher to his snake. I mean, this is and sees his other teacher sit there and let it happen. He is seeing trauma up close and personal, and who knows what he has seen in the interim between the time he ran away and Half-Blood Prince and the time we meet up with him again at the beginning of Deathly Hallows. But you know what, Draco, being the 100% Slytherin he is, he does not have much courage at all. He is at heart very much a coward, and so when he's faced with these horrors, he doesn't have that courage reservoir to draw on that Harry and Neville and Luna and Jenny and everybody who's on the good side does, Ron. He also, I think, you know, he's always looked out for himself, and that's all he can think about. He can't focus on anyone else. And again, that probably goes back to the indulged childhood he had, where he is the center of the universe. So I think between those two things, he is just completely incapable of coping with any sort of trauma. I mean, we saw what happened to him in the Forbidden Forest. He's just, you know, completely freaks out. So that's part of what I see going on with him as well.
Yeah, so it seems like that you see that there's an arc going on with that too, that maybe in the beginning he is, you know, he's an indulged child and, you know, he's not a nice kid, but he's maybe not suffering from particular psychological issues. But especially as he probably witnesses traumatic events, then we do maybe see some problems developing, and we can see that especially, like you said, in book 6 and then as we get into book 7, and that's when he becomes more of a fleshed out character.
Yeah, I think in book 6 that's fair. I don't think before that it's something that comes on with that difficult situation. I do think it's worth remembering though, at the beginning of book 6 we see the most classic school bully moment, where we see him being fawned over by Pansy and his friends, of when Harry enters his coterie by going into the carriage, and that's one of those book 2, book 6 echoes of that, when Harry went into the Slytherin place, you know, when there were in Polyjuice potions. So it's this nice little echo of that. But now, in the first one, Draco had nothing to do with what's going on, you know, so he supports the idea of the Chamber of Secrets from the sidelines, but he's not actually doing anything about it. He doesn't actually understand what being implicated in evil is at that point. He thinks he'd like it from the outside, and then when he's in it in book 6, he doesn't like it after all. But he does, mm-hmm. I mean, what he does to Harry in the carriage there is really quite horrific. It's made quite jokey, right. You know, but actually stamping on his and breaking his nose, like, this is GBH.
It's,
you know,
he's going grotesque
for that.
Yeah.
And it's not just, you know, the early types of bullying, which were generally just being mean about him and mocking him and things like that. You think this really is grotesque. So I wonder whether Rowling puts that there to try and alienate him from us a bit, because she's going to be opening up a more sympathetic reading of him as well. But
we have to hate him in that scene.
Yeah,
when he stomps on Harry's face under the invisibility cloak. I mean,
right.
There's not much there you can say. Well, come on, he's had a tough life. You
know, yeah.
Look, the guy's been spying on him. He deserves this. Now, that's that moment. I want to comment here that Beatrice Grove seems to be arguing from a Ring perspective here. I was a little startled there, Bea. I mean, my goodness, has there been a conversion going on here in the background?
I've always thought there's a chiastic form to the series.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this is
interesting contrast between 2 and 6 is the way he treats Crabbe and Goyle. I mean, most of the way through the series, they are his big hulking bodyguards, you know, really tough guys who are going to stand up for him, and he's going to depend on them for protection. Book 6, he turns them into little girls and makes them guard the room of requirement. I mean, I can only imagine what that did to Crabbe and Goyle. And
that's why they don't like him in book 7.
Yes. In terms of, they have to be the closest thing, maybe other than Pansy, that he has to friends. And yet he completely demasculinates them. And, you know, I think it shows, you know, he can't think of anyone but himself at that point. He's focused on this mission. He really is not caring what happens to anyone else at that point. Makes him just completely unempathetic to anyone, and then really gets confronted with the horrors of what that means.
I want to just pick up on that, Louise, because there's two biblical parallels for Draco, which I think are rather fun, and one of them is that one. So do you remember Harry says to him, I tell my friends what I'm doing. You know, you are just using Crabbe and Goyle as servants. They don't know what they're up to. And that, you know, Jesus says to his friends, I do not call you servants anymore, but friends, for servants do not know what their master is doing.
Oh, wow. Awesome.
It's a good one, isn't it? And I feel that that is echoed by the sort of bigger biblical reference at the end at the lightning struck tower when Dumbledore says to Malfoy, he says, well, he's, you know, Malfoy says, I've got a job to do, but he's not doing it. And Dumbledore says, well, then you must get on and do it, my dear boy. And that's Jesus says to Judas, which that happens so quickly. And that moment of power change, so just like Judas, Malfoy thinks he's been plotting against Dumbledore, and Dumbledore is powerless in his hands. And that moment is when Jesus says to Judas, no, you know, actually, I'm in charge here. I know what's going on, and you do what you've got to do, you know. And Dumbledore's the same when he says, you know, it is my mercy that counts here, Draco, not yours. You think you're in charge. You're not in charge. And I think it's a moment that jumped out at me because it also happens in Macbeth. So when Macbeth leaves the supper, which Duncan is feeding at, so again as a Last Supper moment, he says, if it were to done when it is done, then it would, well, it were done quickly. So it's the exact echo of that same moment. And obviously Macbeth is incredibly influential on Harry Potter, so I sort of think, I wonder if Rowling is getting it, is, as it were, doing a double reference there of both a Macbeth moment and a biblical moment. But either way, neither Macbeth nor Judas are great parallels for Draco, but she does allow him not to do it. You know, so doing that moment that the sort of a Judas moment is held up for him there, and then it doesn't happen. And we do sense, I think, that it was not going to happen, that Draco was actually never going to actually manage to go through and kill Dumbledore.
There's a little thing about his wand almost dropping a little bit right before the others come rushing into the tower.
And that rather sweet moment, which I really like, where he gets sort of courage from Dumbledore praising him. And you think, yes, this is the father figure. You know, this is the father figure that Harry found. This is the father figure you should have found. And you almost do at that moment where you suddenly, he's giving you courage, even if it appears to be courage to kill him. You can see that Dumbledore's reasserting his authority over Malfoy there, and that, yes, he won't kill him.
It answers, I think, a question Louise asked earlier, is why does Dumbledore make Draco a prefect? is that Dumbledore, just like with Ron, where he gives Ron the Deluminator because he knows he'll want to come back, you know, that he makes him a prefect because he has to somehow be a headmaster that recognizes Draco as the most important figure inside Slytherin. And he has to establish some kind of relationship with Draco to set up that moment when, you know, where Draco doesn't just hate him because he didn't make him a prefect. He has a much longer view of this. He knows there's going to be a moment when he has to be able to confront him and say, do you want to be Judas or do you want to be one of my disciples? Yes. And it works out, really. I mean, Dumbledore, as usual, you know, he's got some pretty good guesses here. He's figured out the story arc for Draco, and that if there's a redemption of Draco in the end, it's largely because of that moment. You know, that Draco does have that experience of a man that reached out to him and confronted him with his own choices and made him see himself for what he is.
Absolutely. And of course, that, as well as being a redemption for Draco, that is the reason the whole thing works, that Draco has disarmed Dumbledore there. So that's why he's Master of the Elder Wand, which is why Harry is Master of the Elder Wand, which is why Harry can beat Voldemort without murdering anybody. It's important within Draco's narrative and crucial for the main narrative as well.
And it's disarming and not Avada Kedavra. So it's Expelliarmus, which is, of course, Harry's preferred spell, because it is essentially a statement of nonviolence.
Exactly. And who taught him that spell? Snape. So it's rather nice. Mm-hmm. Sort of, I think the fact that his calling card spell, actually, he learned from.
Cool. And so I wanted to mention, we're talking about the scene in the tower with Dumbledore, that the Pottermore site, which is now called WizardingWorld.com, one of these, sort of fan articles, they must have a series, the chapter that made us fall in love with Draco Malfoy is the tower scene. So that is something that people are sort of referencing as, this is where we understood Malfoy, we fell in love with him. And so to me, the idea that you could fall in love with Malfoy right at this particular moment, it says many things, right, about the bad boy mystique, but also the idea that, you know, this is maybe a time when we do see he is not capable of the terrible mission that he has been given ultimately when he's face to face with Dumbledore, and that little redemption gives people, you know, a little leeway in which they can fall in love with this bad boy character.
Carriage scene and Harry's having his face smashed with his
boot. That would be very worrying if that was the moment.
Now, Roland, go
there's
ahead.
Also those earlier scenes in the Battle of Hogwarts where Draco is biting them, you know, is trying to capture Harry to turn him over to the Dark Lord and get back in the Dark Lord's graces, too, because it's interesting. Of course, he had saved Harry's life back in the manor when he felt so helpless. Now he seems to be back in Hogwarts, has got his henchmen back with him. He's now sort of sliding back into that, okay, I'm going to ally myself with the Dark Lord because that's who's going to win here. And then we would never really see, you know, obviously he experiences the Fiend Fire. He experiences Harry saving his life. How many times during the Battle of Hogwarts does Harry save his life? At least twice, right? Yet we don't really ever see any acknowledgement of that. When, again, you've got Greg Draco kind of ending on this very ambiguous note. Unlike his mom, her last scene is actually her doing the right thing. With Draco, you know, and I always thought it was very interesting when we see him in the Hogwarts Express 19 years later. You know, they're just sort of stare at each other and they just sort of, their eyes meet and they nod each other. They acknowledge that they're not going to be friendly, but they're not going to, you know, actively hate each other. It's just they're almost, Harry's almost indifferent to him at that point.
And, you know, I felt like this was a missed opportunity for me, like in terms of the narrative structure. I would have liked more of a redemptive note for Draco that doesn't have that ambiguity that I totally agree with you, Louise, exists at the end. And, you know, maybe it's more realistic to think that Draco's not going to suddenly, you know, make amends with Harry in that aftermath. But at the same time, like I say, narratively, I wish there had been, I don't know, even a reckoning, something with Draco. And I do feel like the redemptive moments that he has, they're just pretty weak to me. Like, I don't totally buy redemption from him.
I don't think Rowling does she? So that's probably why she didn't want to. Yeah. She didn't want, if she gave him a fully redemptive moment, then all the Draco lovers would be, ha!
Right.
She didn't want. So, I think that moment when in the Fiend Fire is partly to do with Rowling linking up the schoolboy story and the big good versus evil story. So she wants the sort of moment when Harry confronts his bully, to the moment when he thinks, do you remember, he says, you know, surely he wasn't going to be stopped from getting the final Horcrux by Draco, you know, his school bully. So the moment when that sort of school bully school story is integrated into the big good and evil fight each other, Harry versus Voldemort. And I think she just wanted them to sort of mesh in that final moment, just for that narrative structure rather than for Draco's own arc, maybe.
Yeah, it's serving a particular purpose there. Well, what do we think about Rowling herself has said that she's disturbed by the number of young women readers who have these Draco crushes. And she said, like, don't have a crush on Draco. Like, she thinks that's a bad idea. She's not into the bad boy herself, I guess. What do you think is the appeal of Malfoy? And why is Rowling working so hard, maybe outside of the text, but maybe also inside the text with like the stomp on the face, to try to make sure that, you know, readers do have a little distance on him? So what's the appeal? And then why is Rowling and how is Rowling trying to undermine that? What do y'all think?
I don't think that anybody reads just the books really loves Draco or falls in love with him. This is the Tom Felton effect, isn't it? That really,
Tom Felton is appealing as a
He's a charming. No matter how much he sneers, you realize he's acting. He's not a sneering guy.
Yeah.
And that's blended. Just as we don't have a blonde Dudley in the movies, we don't have a really heartless flashman sadist Draco in the movies. And thank God we couldn't find an actor to do that part. Okay, that's something at least. But that is why true love won't redeem him. The only thing that redeems him, and Louise, you've seen the play, you've seen Cursed Child.
Yes, I have.
We do see Draco redeemed.
Yes, I was thinking just the same. So she's followed on from that, and I wonder also in the creation of Scorpius whether she's creating the Draco that she. I was thinking, you know, why on earth does Scorpius end up in Slytherin? He's the loveliest person she's, you know, and I think it must be family loyalty that he just chooses to be where his father was, but he doesn't belong there. And so he's, I think, her attempt to make a sort of Draco who she could find appealing.
The Draco inside the story, though, isn't redeemed by true love. He's redeemed by grief, by remorse. Am I wrong there, Louise?
Well, I mean, I don't think he would have experienced the level of grief he had he not had true love for Astoria. And so I think the two really go hand in hand. You know, we never meet Astoria in the flesh, which is kind of a shame because she must have been a pretty remarkable woman. But, you know, we know that she is... does not have the pure blood hang up. That's another thing, of course, in Draco's childhood. In addition to being indulged, he has also been brought up to feel this very strong prejudice against anyone who is not pure blood. So he's basically being raised as a racist, in addition, along with the spoiled rich boy. And we know Astoria did not have that same attitude, that she was much gentler and much more accepting of muggles and muggle-borns, and obviously was able to pass a lot of that, those traits onto Scorpius. There was something when I saw the play that made me think of All in the Family, of all things, where you had Archie Bunker as this, very bigoted person. And then you had his wife, as this very sweet person without a bigoted bone in her body. And then, of course, you wound up with Gloria, their daughter, who, had this, a very different personality from either of her parents. But, it was a very interesting, the fact that she wasn't as bigoted as her father was probably due to the effects of her mother, and it probably created some conflict. So I think that's part of what happened with Scorpius, is that he had this much less bigoted mother and that influence in the home. Also, I don't know that we have any particular indication that Scorpius was indulged in the same way. That, he clearly is bright and values books and learning and cleverness in a way that Draco never did. Is that because the Malfoy family has just fallen from grace now and they don't have the means to indulge their kid as much? Or is that because, Astoria was a more loving and better mother, even if Narcissa was a very loving mother? Obviously, she loved her son very much to do everything she did for him. Maybe the love Astoria felt for Scorpius was a healthier type of love.
Yeah, and I wonder actually about Draco, because as a father, he actually seems like a better father to me than Lucius. Now, I've only just read the screenplay, but Draco doesn't seem to have the same fathering, misdeeds of Lucius.
No.
Yeah.
He is a much nicer person, and he can do what he can never do in the original series, which is sort of put aside his differences with Harry for the sake of his son now. And that's something we'd never seen from Draco before.
And we're also seeing really bad parenting from Harry in Cursed Child. So,
right.
So Lucius does quite well. Sorry, not Lucius, Draco does quite well in comparison, I think.
Yeah, so my brother has this theory that the Scorpius Albus story, so my brother Rob McDaniel, who's been on the show before, he suggested that he was just totally reminded of when Scorpius and Albus become friends, the, Harry's spurning of Draco's friendship at the beginning of the Sorcerer's Stone, Philosopher's Stone. And that this is sort of, I think the whole play is alternate universe. The whole play is a sort of exploration of what if something different had happened, and that maybe the Albus Scorpius friendship is a reimagining of what a friendship would have been like between a Malfoy and a Potter. That wouldn't have been, I don't think it's possible between Draco and Harry, but maybe in that next generation, something like that would be possible.
Well, yeah. I think there's definitely a parallel between, them meeting on the train and sharing candy the same way that Harry and Ron did. And in this case, Scorpius is sort of the outsider. He's the one who's rumored to be the son of Voldemort, and Albus is using his, even though Albus winds up not very socially accepted himself, at that point he is kind of using his privilege of being a Potter to embrace this outsider, this void, in the same way that Harry befriended Ron, and how they helped each other at that point. What's interesting, of course, the one who plays the Draco role in that case is Rose. Hermione and Ron's daughter is the one who says, we need to be very picky about who we're friends with. And, I'm not going to hang around with this loser. You come with me and you find me the good friends. And Albus basically says to her, I think I can figure out who the right people are for myself. Thanks. Almost exactly word for word the way Harry does.
Yeah.
So that's, when you have the Granger Weasley being, if anything, the bully in the series, that the next generation has just sort of been turned on its head.
Yeah, I do wonder if, could we imagine Harry having shaken Draco's hand? Could we imagine him saying, yeah, I'll be your friend? Or is it just not possible? Would it have been bad, I guess, is what I'm saying. Would it have been really the good thing for Harry to do to become Draco's friend? And in the sense that the cursed child sort of shows us what might be possible, although those are different characters, obviously. Could Harry and Draco have been friends?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Harry, you know, Harry's remarkably perceptive. He recognized what Draco was that day one in Madame Malkin's. And I think he also recognized who the Weasleys were in terms of their compassion and their caring and their, and he, no way, if he has to choose between the two, he's going to make the right choice there.
Yeah, I just think Scorpius is not anything like Draco. So it's not, you know, it, what she's done is rewritten a Slytherin as nice, but I just don't think he reads as a Slytherin like us. I don't think it works. But I like him as a character very much, and Draco just isn't going to be someone like that just because Harry is friendly to him.
So I wonder if, because the cursed child is not exactly J.K. Rowling, it's not exactly her writing and vision, is the Draco in Cursed Child, is that the same Draco? Or do we consider that to be actually a different character who would have had, who would have been able to have that, you know, that transformative experience, whether through love or through grief with Astoria, and to be this better father? Is that, you know, an alternate timeline itself and not really an outgrowth of the original, what's possible in the original series? What do you think?
Well, I felt this way when I read the screenplay, and I didn't really change my mind when I saw the play. As much as I really loved the play as a production, the Cursed Child became a different timeline the moment Harry said goodbye to Albus on the train, at the train station, and didn't say, well, what if, you know, Albus asks, what if I am put in Slytherin? You know, then Slytherin will gain a brilliant young wizard. It doesn't matter to us. I mean, that whole line is not there. And that, I think, that's such a crucial thing for the next generation, is that if Harry truly is okay with his son being a Slytherin, because he's recognized what Snape did for him, and because he recognizes that, you know, maybe we swore too soon, as Dumbledore has said. But, you know, the Harry of Cursed Child did not feel that way. I mean, to me, that starts the whole series off on something completely different. And, you know, Albus departs with his parents being very worried about him, in a way that Harry, when he's there on the train taking all was well, he doesn't have that fear for Albus that the Harry of the play did. So I think it's at that moment, that's kind of the time turner moment when it became something completely different and really not fitting with that epilogue scene in the book.
Yeah, I agree, Louise. That basically what you get in Cursed Child is Slytherin fan fiction. It's not, and Rowling closes off the end of the series, so no one can go anywhere because of Cursed Child. It's not canon. It's not the 7-book series. So we talk about Draco there. It's Draco and another person's imagination and such, and it's fascinating to talk about, especially. But as Louise says, we don't meet Astoria, so we don't know.
And I absolutely loved seeing, the actor who played Draco in the New York production that I saw was outstanding. I mean, there were a lot of his mannerisms. He had the ponytail like Lucius. The way he carried himself was very similar to Lucius. You could see that echo, but his actions were completely different. And particularly when they're in the Voldemort ruling timeline, when they're in that dark timeline where Voldemort has won and Draco is a very powerful figure under the rule of Voldemort, and Draco realizes this is a really, really bad place to be, and I think the Draco of the book would have been, if he could have succeeded and been successful and wealthy and powerful under Voldemort, he'd have been happy to put up with Voldemort. And this Draco realized something was wrong with that.
That's really interesting. And I think I haven't seen the play, but I do ultimately think you can even get that from the reading of it as well. Now, if we think about Draco symbolically, you know, I opened with some, you know, some Latin things. The motto of Hogwarts is never tickle a sleeping dragon. And the nemesis of Harry at Hogwarts is Draco or dragon. And of course, his last name, Malfoy, means bad faith. J.K. Rowling has an article, by the way, on Pottermore, which is now Wizarding World, where she talks a little bit about the different names she tried out for the Malfoys until she ultimately landed on Malfoy. The other ones are kind of funny, which is interesting. And Malfoy is not a funny last name. But she ends up with Dragon Bad Faith for this character. And I wonder, what do we think about the symbolism of Draco and the dragon? And of course, he's in Slytherin with the snake. Is this matching up with other symbols of the dragon or the snake that J.K. Rowling is building into the story?
So I'd just like to start off on that, and the names, the two names. So Malfoy probably comes from Spencer's Fairy Queen, in that there's a bad guy in the Fairy Queen called Sansfoy, without faith. So I wonder if that was the sort of place where she came across the name. And as she says in that Pottermore article, he has an Anglo-Norman background, which is a very... they were the aristocrats in England in the medieval times. So she's very much feeding in a sort of an aristocratic idea of a French name. Draco, I think, is I think a lot of people don't realise how snaky dragons are. And she's pointing that out. So in Greek, Dracos are, they can be snakes or dragons pretty indeterminately. And the constellation aspect of the name. So as everybody knows, loads of pureblood names are star-based: Merope, Sirius, Regulus, Arcturus, Orion, Cassiopeia, Scorpius, etc. These are constellations or stars. And I think that comes from the fact that Lucifer is a star name. So I think that's why she thought constellations or stars would be good dark names.
Oh, cool.
But if you look at Draco, the constellation Draco, it's a snake. It's incredibly long. So listeners might like to go and look that up, and you'll see that it is in fact a snake. And it's the serpent that guarded the tree of the golden apples in the Hesperides in Greek myth. That links it specifically with the snake that Satan inhabits in Eden, which is obviously a snake and an apple. And that makes the name actually an arch Slytherin name. Although we think dragon, it's also absolutely a snake name.
Yeah, and of course, both Draco and Scorpius are named after these constellations, who are dangerous monsters of some sort. You've got a scorpion and you've got a snake, sort of the two primal fears, other than a spider, that a lot of people have, just because these are, you know, in an evolutionary sense, dangerous creatures for humans. So it's very easy to learn to fear them. So I think that name that is supposed to inspire fear, poison, power, fire, you know, all those stuff is in there. The name. What was the role of Andromeda in mythology?
Andromeda was the woman who was freed by Perseus from the sea snake.
From the sea snake. Okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking that. Of course, Andromeda is the one who leaves the snake family and marries the Muggleborn and separates herself.
Exactly. So it's a perfect.
Okay. I was
perfect parallel.
I was thinking
yeah.
that was the case, but I didn't want to speak in case I was wrong. So thank you for confirming that for me. Neat thing like that.
It is really nice, and it's also linked to the Perseus and Andromeda have a version of St. George and the Dragon. So the St. George dragon and freeing the dragon often has a woman who he's saving her from is a sort of perfect analogue to Perseus, Andromeda, and the sea monster.
Okay.
What about, we know that Harry has a certain sympathy with snakes. Harry's able, we learned that in the zoo, in the very beginning of the books. And he has the ability to speak to snakes, even to a basilisk. what does that mean? Draco's name means serpent, and Harry has this capacity, perhaps from the soul fragment that he has unwillingly. But he has the ability to understand serpents. Does Harry have a unique ability to understand Draco?
I like it as an idea. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. He's certainly obsessive about Draco.
He understood that Draco was lowering his wand and was not going to kill Dumbledore. He shares that with everybody.
And I suppose so, he, in the sort of what John has called the sucker punch of book six, where as usual he is thinking Draco's up to no good and everyone else goes, no, I don't think he is, but he's right about Draco in the last, in book six. So that's another aspect of him sort of seeing what's going on with Draco, I suppose.
And when Harry uses Sectum Sempra and seriously injures Draco, he is very quickly regretful of that. I mean, I think he has, it's interesting. I was just rereading that scene the other day. And Ron, interestingly, was the only one that was really defending Harry at that point. He points out that, you know, Draco was trying to use an unforgivable curse. He was trying to use Crucio on Harry and Harry comes back with this Sectum Sempra, which of course is reckless because he doesn't know what it does. And when he sees it's this dark, basically a slicing open type of spell, you know, he instantly is like struck and, you know, would not have done this literally to his worst enemy. and I think that goes with him understanding on a fundamental level that everyone is human. I mean, he can even say to Tom Riddle at the end, you know, try for some remorse, and, you know, tries to give him that last chance to grasp at some level of redemption himself. And of course he can't do it, but I think Harry does have that strong inner sense of morality and that sense of, you know, there are some things not even your worst enemy deserves.
And I guess to me, that's because I think about, you know, we were talking about the foot on the face that Draco delivers to Harry at the beginning that's so horrible. But then I think about Sectum Sempra toward the end, also, right, horrific. But Louise, you've done a nice job pointing out that there's some real differences in the way that we, in the context in which those are delivered, and also the response of Harry versus the response of Draco. Draco covers up Harry with the invisibility cloak and says, you know, enjoy your trip back to King's Cross, basically. And Harry is instantly regretful, and he will never use that spell again. We know that. So,
well, he tries it on Snape.
Oh, does he? I guess I forgot that.
He does say it, doesn't he? Yeah. He says, you dare use my own spell against me.
Yeah, he tries it on Snape. Yeah. Snape killed Dumbledore.
Maybe he didn't learn.
and he also tried it on the Inferi, but I guess you can forgive him for that. Of course, it doesn't do any good. It quite slices their clothes open, but there's no blood for them to shed, so it doesn't do any good. So he does try it at least twice.
Okay, all right.
But, the sibilant nature of that spell, all the S's and such, really marks it as a Slytherin weapon. And that Harry uses it speaks to his inner Slytherin, and it's not something he's comfortable with. It's basically the same thing that makes him has the capacity to speak to snakes. He doesn't know where this comes from. Sectum Sempra would clearly be an unforgivable curse if it was widely known. It's a murder spell. It's meant to kill.
And in many ways, it's worse than Avada Kedavra. At least Avada Kedavra is a quick, painless death, presumably. And Sectum Sempra, you're going to lie there and bleed out. It's going to, you know, pretty hard.
Yeah. and so that Harry uses it on Snape, and then, you know, after the Inferi cave, that's
I think you can use unforgivable curses on Inferi the same way you can on spiders. They're okay.
Okay.
You can't kill them if they're already dead. So
I guess the relationship between Harry and Draco, because of the name, back to the name question. Harry has a peculiar relationship with serpents because of the Horcrux that he has on his forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, the Sorting Hat sees it, right? The Sorting Hat wants to put him in Slytherin. This this is the ambiguity in Harry, and it's being resolved in clearly in Half-Blood Prince and in the Crucible of Deathly Hallows, so that he chooses not to take the Hallows. He goes after the Horcruxes. We have to set that up, and we set that up with him acting like a Slytherin, really, at the end of Half-Blood Prince.
Well, and he also, in the Half-Blood Prince, he's so preoccupied with Draco that he's forgetting to do what Dumbledore is asking him to do, which is really about the Horcruxes. And so he's already kind of had that lesson about, you know, focus on what Dumbledore wants you to be doing, and you shouldn't be looking at, you know, the Death Eater, what the Death Eater's goals are. Those are not to be your goals. And that's a hard lesson for him to learn when Draco is the Death Eater that he is following, and he's obsessed with him in book six, always looking at his map, trying to figure out where Draco might be. Now, I think that the dragon part is interesting. I gave a guest speech at Mythmoot with Signum University over the summer, and their theme was dragons. And I was like, what am I going to talk about with dragons and Harry Potter? Because although there are dragons, I think there are mixed messages about dragons through the series.
And seriously misunderstood creatures.
Yes, and that we're supposed to have some sympathy for the dragons. You know, you've got Norbert. How can you not like little Norbert, the Norwegian Ridgeback? And then
who puts Ron in the hospital for a week?
That's right. Norberta is anything but harmless. But.
No, that's true. It is Norberta. That's right. And then we get the dragon who, in the Goblet of Fire, is protecting its egg, and that Harry is, you know, actually all the Triwizard Tournament contestants are having to, like, make a dragon think that you're stealing the egg. And so again, I don't think Rowling necessarily, I mean, we don't blame the dragon for being protective that way. And then at the very end in Deathly Hallows, we have this dramatic liberation of the aging dragon.
And the abused dragon.
Abused, right, yeah. In Gringotts.
And we are delighted when he gets out and has the cool water on his scars, or when he gets free and drinks. I think it's a very positive moment for him. So are you following this through with the redemptive arc of Draco then?
I don't know. I was just sort of thinking that through. I'm thinking out loud, really. But I just wonder if that's, are we supposed to be seeing that Draco would have that? But, you know, I guess Draco is liberated in the end, and liberated by Harry with the defeat of the Death Eaters. Maybe that's a parallel that's worth drawing.
Oh, Harry pulls them out of the Fiend Fire. That's another, I think that's probably the biggest liberation movement, is that you're rescuing him from that.
Right, as a physical liberation. I was thinking more the mental liberation of being rescued from that very traumatic state of being a Death Eater. And I just think about what is he experiencing that whole year of the Deathly Hallows, where Voldemort's like camped out at Malfoy Manor. And as you described, some of the terrible events, and those are only the ones that we see, but there are all kinds of horrible events that Malfoy is privy to. And, you know, he's trapped in a way.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, of course, he sees done to his own father. I mean, he sees his father's wand get taken. Obviously, you know, by the end of it, Voldemort is just heaping abuse on abuse, punishment after punishment on Lucius. And even while he's, you know, basically taken over their home, it's, you know, that again, that I think is a trauma that Draco is just completely inequipped to cope with.
Right. And the moment that I fell in love with Draco, if I ever did,
John,
was when Harry is brought into Malfoy Manor, and Draco has his moment where he can say, absolutely, that's Harry Potter. Cut him up, you know, or bind him and give him to the Dark Lord. He balks. There's his moment. His foe that's largely responsible for, you know, his being in this position he is, in terms of what Draco is constantly trying to fight Harry Potter as brought him to the position that he's in at the end in Deathly Hallows. He doesn't take his revenge there and say, you know, Harry Potter, turn him over to the Dark Lord. That moment is, to me, the really the redemption of him and why Harry Potter is able to save him. I mean, Ron is absolutely not on board with saving.
If we die saving him, I will kill you, Harry. I love you.
That's one of the great Ron non sequiturs in the book. But Ron's reaction. Ron never gives up on that. You know, we saved you again. You know, later in that same battle. You know, when are you going to turn into a nice guy? You know, that.
What was always just a little odd. Remind me, was Lucius was present at that scene where they brought Harry as? I know he was in the movie, but
he was in the book as well. He says, "You know him." Yeah, he's asking him. Yeah. He says, "You know him." You know, yeah.
I mean, Lucius knows what Harry and Ron and Hermione look like. He's seen them in Flourish and Blots. He's seen them in the Quidditch World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Prophecy.
Yeah, I think the question is,
this is the weird. It's always been strange to me that Lucius was not as desperate as he was to please the Dark Lord at that moment. Why in the world would you not? You've got this redhead, you've got this bushy head girl, and you've got a boy with a scar on his forehead. You know, can you not figure? Are you not 100% sure that these are the ones you're looking for? I mean, Lucius has seen them enough that he ought to know that. That was always strained credulity to me to have Lucius insist that only Draco can identify them. It's like, no, you've met these kids several times. You could figure it out.
Is he trying to give Draco an opportunity to impress the Dark Lord or something, though? I mean, is he sort of handing an opportunity to him?
I think he would sacrifice his own ability to impress the Dark Lord to let his son do it. I mean, he wants that wand back, or he wants, mm-hmm. you know, he wants to be restored to a position of power, and he's lost a lot more than Draco has. I don't see, as indulgent as the Malfoys are as parents, I don't see Lucius push coming to shove really sacrificing his son if he had a choice between that and saving his own skin. I mean, that's ultimately, I think, the biggest tragic flaw in the Slytherins is ultimately they will look out for themselves first,
mm-hmm.
even sometimes at the expense of their closest loved ones.
But Draco is not doing that here. Draco doesn't take the opportunity that's presented to him.
He does not. Yeah. And I think that's because he's been just traumatized and he just wants to get away from this battle. And I think when push comes to shove, he really doesn't want to see any more of the people he knew at Hogwarts murdered in front of his eyes.
You know, in that Pottermore/Wizarding World essay, she's got a specific essay about Draco Malfoy, and Rowling talks about how she sort of started with the cardboard character, and then she did seek to give him some kind of developmental arc. But she, you know, she acknowledges that it's not that big of an arc, and that essentially mm-hmm. Draco discovers that he's not a murderer. It's a pretty low bar,
Pretty low bar,
you know. But he really—that's the essence of it. He discovers he's not a killer, and
one step ahead of his dad.
Yes, right. I mean, it is a significant bar. It's just that for the rest of us, might seem a little low. But he had actually tried to kill Dumbledore on the two occasions, right? And he almost kills Ron. He almost kills Katie Bell, and. So he's close to being a murderer, but Dumbledore sort of seems to think those are pretty half-hearted attempts. And when it comes to, again, the face-to-face killing, he's not able to do it. And if his action of revealing Harry would then lead to Harry's immediate death, I think that he would, you know, he especially by the Deathly Hallows, he's realized, like, that's my line. I'm not going to cross line.
I think that point about what he does to Dumbledore, I think what Dumbledore is saying there is that these are very half-hearted attempts to kill Dumbledore, which I think they are. You know, they don't really, but
right.
He's not worried about the fact they might backfire and kill other people. So it is a kind of, he can only take responsibility at one remove. You know, if he's the person he's directly trying to kill, he can't quite screw his courage sticking post to do it, but he's willing to behave in ways that will endanger other people. And as you say, Ron is a whisper away from dying as a result of Malfoy's behavior, so we shouldn't feel too sympathetic towards him, I think.
Yeah, so let's wrap it up. Like, what do you think is the final word on Draco? I think we've had really interesting conversation here. I'll just reveal to you, I asked my son, who's the Harry Potter fan in among my children, I asked him, you know, what do you think of Draco? And he did not have the, like, visceral antipathy toward Draco that I would have guessed he had. And he sort of came out with the idea, oh, Draco, I guess Draco is okay. And then I tried to point out all the nasty things that Draco did, and he was like, well, but on the other hand, and so he was not inclined. He's a very sweet boy, my Hal. So he was not inclined to throw him to the wolves. But I wonder, like, do we think that, is Draco really just right for the story? Is he a missed opportunity for Rowling that she could have done more with? You know, do we think he's okay in the end? What do y'all think? Let's start with B on this one.
I don't think he's okay. And I think that she didn't give him more of a redemptive arc because she didn't want us to think that he's okay. So that's my reading. And maybe she backtracked on that with Cursed Child and allowed him a redemptive moment in that, I'd say. Yeah.
And don't romanticize him. Don't romanticize him,
exactly.
Girls and boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is this appeal. We didn't really follow up on that, but there is the appeal of bad boy. It's a kind of... I feel like it's a tough trap for a lot of, especially girls. I loved Mr. Rochester when I first read Jane Eyre, and then I read Jane Eyre in college, and I was like, oh, no way. I've just had a revelation, you know, a little bit more age and experience.
What about Heathcliff? Did you like Heathcliff?
I always hated Heathcliff. I'd never liked that.
That's okay.
So
you know, you wouldn't really have fallen for Draco then.
No, I know. That's right. But anyway, even I have had a little bit of the bad boy thing, but I would never have liked Draco. But the idea that we shouldn't be romanticizing him, and maybe she's concerned enough about that she doesn't want to make it seem like, oh, he really had a heart of gold under all of that destructive behavior. She doesn't want people to have that be the takeaway for them. John, what do you think about this?
Draco never separates himself ultimately from his family, and he never separates himself from his identity inside the school. Never transcends any of the roles that his life script have given him. And for Rowling, who's really a subversive reader, you know, she's after our trying to escape our narratives and examine them and come to terms with the reality beneath the narrative. Draco is a bad guy. Draco is the failed reader in a book that's about reading and writing. There's ultimately no redemption for him because he winds up still being Draco Malfoy in the end. I mean, they nod to each other, but he hasn't transcended the world or saved it the way Harry has. We're definitely in the opposition of Harry and Draco. Just as Harry has the ultimate heroism, he's acted out the chosen one thing and in the ways that Bea has described both here in this podcast and in her wonderful book. In a very Christ-like way, and Draco is the serpent. Draco is the Lucifer isn't really redeemed at the end of that story either. So I'm with you that no, Draco is not redeemed in the end, and that he's the reader that we're not supposed to be.
Well, I mean, there are four major bad guys in the book. There's Voldemort, ultimate villain, of course. There is Draco Malfoy, there is Snape throughout most of the book, most of the series, there is Umbridge. You know, Harry has this collection of nemesis. Of course, the one he has to defeat is Voldemort. Snape, of course, has that, you know, unique role of the big reveal at the end that, you know, impresses Harry enough that he names his child for him. So this is he's kind of in a category by itself. We never see any redemptive moment for Umbridge, but we never really know what happens to her either. She's not at the battle. She's just sort of dropped after we meet her that last time. We don't know what happens to her next. Dudley has that moment where there's a little bit of melting, that maybe there's can be this not altogether hostile relationship. And I think Draco has that kind of same thing when you know, at, by the time they're adults, they're just sort of staring at each other with a lot of indifference.
Yeah, and the epilogue.
And mm-hmm. you know, I think that's good. I think having those ambiguities, that leaves it open to the reader's imagination. You know, where is this going from here? You know, is... you hear, it's interesting, Ron is the one who, of course, at the end is joking about to Rose, you know, you better beat Scorpius on every test. It seems like Ron has still kind of maintaining that grudge or that rivalry between the Malfoys that they had as kids. Harry just isn't. He's just like indifferent, neutral, not overtly hostile, but never going to be friendly with you. And I think that's a good way to end that note on, because, you know, if he was, you know, if all the villains got thrown into the pit with Voldemort and they were all destroyed at the end, we'd have a much more simplistic book. And I like the ambiguity, the open-endedness of some of these characters, because then we can imagine what happens. I have some great imagination about what happened to Umbridge, but...
yeah, I think you're right, Louise. There's a maturity there to that understanding of how, you know, people don't always end up like on one side or the other, or they were enemies and now they're friends. And, you know, I mean, I think we've all had the experience of, you know, reunions and so on, where you have that, you know, the people that you didn't like so much when you were in school or you had difficult times with, and you don't have to be friends in the end. And that is not necessarily the complex adult reality that exists for a lot of people. As you know, you don't really necessarily even need that kind of resolution. There's something in that I think is a kind of mature revelation. So, all right, well, thank you all very much. This has really been fascinating. You know, I do sometimes think Draco in my mind is a more simple character, but we have teased out through our conversation some very interesting complexities, some, I think, topics for debate. Listeners, if you want to get in on some of the debate there. And so I'd just like to thank very much Louise Freeman and Beatrice Groves for being on the podcast today. Thank you so much for being here.
Always
thank
a pleasure.
You for having us, yeah.
And we will look forward to Louise. You do a lot of blogging at Hogwarts Professor, really cool stuff on Hogwarts Professor. And so we'll be looking forward to your forthcoming writings. And B, your Batilda's Notebook, I always think has really fascinating analysis there, as it suits my historian's sensibilities for sure.
Thank you. I really glad to enjoy it.
Yeah. And thanks to you, John, of course, for being our expert guest today.
Oh, you're funny. I love being here. I love being thanked for things I would climb mountains to be.
I do. We got all only experts on the show today, I guess I would say. I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you.
Yay!
For all that you do, Emma. She's awesome. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999, and Lori Beckoff, our very Latin competent MuggleNet liaison and producer. Thank you, Laurie. Dear listeners, we are also glad you joined us today, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And now I will leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time, when we'll be using our words to make some magic!